Okay, so I'd like to move on to modern statistical methods. The classical methods that we've talked about, as I've mentioned before, were basically adapted to low levels of computational power and to highly informative data compared to what we'll call big data. The subject of statistics has changed dramatically in the last two or three or four decades. I don't want to remember how long ago because that means I'm getting old. But when I was in graduate school in the early 1980s, Bayesian statistics were not something that was necessarily taught except by Bayesian statisticians. And the big data techniques developed somewhat after that in the 90s, and especially the late 90s, early 2000s began to show up in ordinary usage. Partly this is just due to the fact that people were doing research on these things. Bayesian statistics started to be done before most people could really afford the amount of computational power needed to use many of their methods. And so it was, you know, a research topic. Now there's a lot more research going on because people are actually using these methods. And also big data as well has led to the development of lots of new research methods. It's also partly due, as I've already mentioned, the big data to these new kinds of data, like big data from sensor systems, point of sale data for retail establishments. Social networks provide huge amounts of big data. And we also have got panel data from large-scale surveys, mostly in the United States. Only a couple of years ago, the Michigan Panel Survey and the National Longitudinal Survey, Michigan Panel is mostly supported by government grants, and the National Longitudinal Survey is done by the Bureau of the Census, so it's a government thing as well. But what is especially interesting about those is that they collect fairly detailed data on household behavior over the entire life cycle. And that's what happened a couple of years ago, was that we finally had the last reports from a few people who got in when they were 15 and continued all the way to normal retirement age of 65. So we had a full 50-year cycle on the Michigan Panel and National Longitudinal Surveys, an entire working life. And I assume that those people will continue to participate as they retire. But the interesting thing here is that really the economy runs on workers, right? Workers and capital in some sense. But it's really the workers who are the big news almost all the time. And so now we finally have a full life cycle's worth of data on households and their consumer behavior and their working behavior. Finally, a lot of the new statistical methods require a lot of computation, but it's gotten to the point where for less than the price of a used car, you can get a very powerful computer with multiple GPUs that can do trillions of computations in a second, or sometimes more than that, and it fits on your desktop in an ordinary pizza box kind of machine. So all of these trends have helped us to improve on our statistical methods. The first thing that I want to talk about is Bayesian statistics, because in fact Bayesian statistics has been around for a long time. I talked about the classical methods and I mentioned that Bayesian statistics have some advantages. Well, this has been recognized since like the 1930s or so. In the earliest time, there was a big debate about how to understand hypothesis testing. Because remember, usually the interesting result is when you reject the null hypothesis. So you have a hypothesis of no effect, and now you want to reject that hypothesis and get a result. But there are a number of things that we'd also like to know about that process, such as the power of our tests and so on. And even with the null hypothesis, there are some severe interpretation problems that we have with those older methods. And at the time, Bayesian statistics sort of came up somewhat later, in the 40s and 50s, but people were recognizing at that time the same things that they do today, which is that many of the usual ways of interpreting significance levels, for example, are not very coherent and they don't really make a lot of sense. So the normal way we think about this is, suppose that you do an experiment and you collect data on your experiment. You have a bunch of data and you determine that based on your null hypothesis and your scientific theory, you come up with your alternative and you have your model and you estimate your model and you decide that the probability that under the null hypothesis that there's no effect that you're looking for, the probability of seeing the data that you do is 5%. This is considered good enough to be significant in most cases. And the reason that we consider that a good result is that we think as follows. According to this, the probability of this occurring is 5%. And so the odds are 20-1 against the null hypothesis being true. But there are two problems with this. The first problem is simply that that's not true. You are either correct or incorrect, and there's no odds about it in reality. So what is this likelihood? If you are incorrect and the null hypothesis is false, your calculation on the probability of rejection was done using the wrong numbers. And so what can that possibly mean? Once you've accepted it, you have invalidated the computation that caused you to accept it. So there's a problem of the coherence of the statistical model with the behavior that you've taken. The second problem that you have is that with the assumption that there's a probability of 20%, this doesn't actually correspond to the way scientists behave. There's a phenomenon called the shelving problem or the desk drawer problem. And that is, when scientists get an inconclusive or can't reject the null hypothesis result, this is not very interesting. There's no effect, so we can't use it, right? The idea in a regression, for example, is suppose that, for example, giving a child 2 years of pre-kindergarten reading instruction leads to a 10-point increase in hensachi when they are 20 and trying to get into college. Then that would be really good. But the thing is that every time somebody rejects or accepts the null hypothesis, rejects the alternative that there's a strong effect of pre-kindergarten reading instruction on the probability of getting into college or the hensachi of getting into college, they put it in a desk drawer. They don't report it. This is not very interesting to your typical research journal. And so what is the probability that somebody gets it and reports it is actually much higher than that 5% in social reality. So there are these two problems with the usual interpretation of the p-value of 5% or the judgment of significance at that level that we typically have. So Bayesian can actually address both of these problems. So let's recall what Bayes' law is and start to understand how Bayesian statistics works. Bayesian statistics is named in honor of the Reverend Thomas Bayes, who lived in the 18th century from 1701 to 1761. One of the key ideas of Bayesian statistics is that probability is orderly opinion and inference from data is none other than the revision of such opinion in the light of new relevant information. This is from an article by Edwards, Lindemann, and Savage. And Savage is important to us because he is one of the fathers of the expected utility theory that economists use and also many other social sciences use, often as a sort of null hypothesis that they want to reject, although economists tend to use it as a maintained hypothesis. We just assume it's true. So the simplest case is Bayes' law. We have some initial probability PA that A is happening. And then we get the information that some some event B has occurred, and we want to know how to update and get a new probability that A would occur. And Bayes' law shows how to do this. We take our original probability A, we take the event P of B given A, which A is our null hypothesis, right? A is our null hypothesis. And then we divide that by the probability that B ever occurs and multiply that by our original probability. And now we get a new probability based on the information of B. So let's go back to the taxi cab case. A cab was involved in a hit-and-run accident at night, and two cab companies, the green and the blue, operate in the city. And their cars are painted the same colors as the names of the companies. Now, 85% of the cabs in the city are green and 15% are blue. It happens that a witness identified the cab as being blue. Now, it was at night, so green and blue are a little bit difficult to distinguish, and the court had the witness look at various colors of car at that time of night or at a similar darkness and concluded that the witness identified each color 80% of the time correctly and failed 20% of the time. So if the car was blue and the witness looked at it, they would conclude that it was blue 80% of the time, and they would say it was green 20% of the time. Same thing the other way around for the green car. If it was green and they looked at it, then 80% of the time when they were looking at green cars, they actually did say green. 20% of the time when they were looking at green cars, they said blue instead. The fact that this is symmetric here is just an accident. It makes it easier to state the conditions. So we want to know what the probability that the cab involved was blue rather than green. We're trying to decide who to arrest or whatever. Or we're trying to sue one of the companies and get compensation for the accident. So to use Bayes' law, we need to define events A and B and then do our updating. So let's say that A is the event that the cab in the accident was blue, and B is the event that the witness identifies the cab as blue. So we have a witness who says blue, and we want to know the probability, in fact, that the car was blue. So this is the probability of the car being blue, given that the witness said so. Now, what was the probability of the car being blue if we had no witness? That's pretty easy. 15% of the cars are blue, so we would expect that the probability is 15%, or 0.015, based on the fraction of blue cabs in the city. We know that the probability that of B being, the probability that the witness identifies the cab as blue, given that the car is blue, is actually 80%. That's the reliability testing part. And Bayes' law says that the probability of A given B is the probability of B given A, that's the reliability probability, multiplied by the probability of A, that's the fraction of blue cabs, divided by the probability of B, which is the probability that the witness says blue. So we need to find out what the probability of blue is. This is where things get a little bit complicated. There is a law of probability that says that the probability of B is equal to the probability of B and A, and plus the probability of B and not A. How do we know that? Well, B and A, A and not A together make up omega, the sure event. So that's all the probability of B there is. And the probability of B and A, and the probability of B and not A, are disjoint with each other. They can't happen together, because we insist that in the first case A happens, and then the second case that A doesn't happen. So they can't happen together. That means we can add those two probabilities and get that result. Given the definition of conditional probability, we have that the probability of B is equal to the probability of B given A times P of A, and we know both of those. Right? P of A is given by the fraction of cars in the city, and P of B given A is the fraction of is the probability that the witness says blue, given that the car is blue, which we know from the reliability test. We also want to know what is the probability of B given not A multiplied by the probability of not A. The probability of not A is just what probability is left over if the car is not blue, and that's the probability of a green car, which is 85%. The probability of B given not A, the probability that he says blue if the car is actually green, is 20%. So we can get the probability of B by adding the probability of B given A times the probability of A plus the probability given not A times the probability of not A, which is equal to 0.8 times 0.15 plus 0.2 times 0.85, which is 0.29. We now have the denominator for Bayes' law. We put this into Bayes' law. We get the probability of A given B is 0.8 times 0.15 divided by 0.29, which is 0.41. This is pretty amazing, isn't it? The witness is 80% reliable. However, the chance that the witness saw green and said blue is quite high, in fact, because there are so many green cars. And that's what we have evaluated here. And we discover that, in fact, the probability that we should estimate is less than half. The witness is 80% reliable, but we knock him down to about half that, of only 40% reliable. So, in fact, the probability is higher that the car was green, even though the witness said that the car was blue. This is pretty counterintuitive, and very few juries really accept this logic. However, and this is a very common problem. People don't really understand this logic. It's called the base rate fallacy. It's called a fallacy because the logic is wrong, and the fallacy is that we ignore the base rate. Here the base rate is the percentage of blue cars, which is very low. So the reliability of the witness means we update the base probability of 15% quite a bit to 40%, almost three times as much, but it's still not half. And that's counterintuitive because the witness is 80% reliable. So how do we use this kind of logic in general statistics? Well, in Bayesian statistics, we update whole distributions in the same way. The distribution before collecting the data and updating is called a prior distribution. The distribution after updating is called the posterior distribution. The posterior distribution is used for prediction or hypothesis testing in the same way we use any estimated distribution in statistics. The prior distribution summarizes the information we have in advance. It may be informative, which means we have a pretty tight distribution. We pretty much know what we think is going on. It might be weakly informative. We want to rule out some exceptional cases. Or it might be quite uninformative or diffuse, in which case we try to provide a distribution that says we really don't know anything about what's going on here. An informative prior distribution might be used in the case of a distribution with a history. So for example, if we're interested in climate change, we can check the distributions of temperatures on June 1st at Tokyo Station for a very long period of time. In particular, we can go all the way back to 1901. And we can check that annually for 100 years to 2000. Then we can look at the posterior distribution for the mean temperature after updating based on the temperatures for 2001 to 2017. This check is an analysis of variance, and the chi-squared test is used. A weakly informative prior distribution is used to constrain the posterior distribution to reasonable values. We could use a normal distribution with a mean of 20 degrees and a standard deviation of 5 degrees, meaning that our prior probability of a mean temperature on June 1st is of less than 0 degrees or greater than 40 degrees is less than 0.01%, 0.001%. There's a lot of weight around the mean of 20 degrees, but the really unreasonable possibilities of a freezing temperature on June 1st or a temperature greater than 40 degrees, which is, you know, going to kill people on June 1st, is very unlikely. Finally, an uninformative distribution is one which is chosen arbitrarily to constrain the posterior as little as possible. Uniform distributions with a very wide range are sometimes used, and there's a process called the Jeffries distribution, which is not a single distribution, but a systematic method for constructing uninformative distributions based on the shape of the distribution that you expect after collecting your data. Now, you've heard of the law of large numbers, but the law of large numbers that we usually teach in college statistics courses is based on classical statistics. There's also a law of large numbers for Bayesian statistics, which is called the Bernstein von Mises theorem. And this theorem tells us first that weakly informative and uninformative priors will give results that are similar to frequentist statistics, to the classical results. So in some sense, the classical results seem to be pretty good against Bayesian statistics in the case where we don't know very much about what's going on. But remember that in many cases, we do have a pretty good idea of what's going on. If something is a hot research topic and only one person is actually reporting results, we can assume that other people did similar experiments and didn't get the same results and put them in their desk drawer. So we might have a relatively informative prior distribution that the null hypothesis is correct, that there is no effect. And in that case, we would use that base rate, and that would make things much more pessimistic for our hypothesis test if we were doing it correctly by the Bayes method. Whereas the frequentist method always gives the same result. The Bernstein von Mises theorem gives a central limit theorem for Bayesian statistics in general, and in particular, there's, as usual, there's a convergence to a normal distribution if you have a large enough sample. The strength of the theorem is that convergence is regardless of prior. So it doesn't really matter what it is. Eventually you get to a normal distribution if you have enough data. The theorem is difficult to prove, and it's somewhat fragile in the sense that from a mathematician's point of view, the assumptions you have to make for it are pretty strong. However, it's good enough for practical research. The kinds of distributions that as priors that would cause a problem for Bernstein von Mises are pretty wild distributions that we normally would not experience. So we have two interesting results here. First of all, that Bayesian statistics with uninformative priors is basically the same as traditional frequentist statistics. But if we have information from our priors, we may be able to do better. Also, Bayesian statistics gives us a way to correct for the desk drawer problem. Second, we get a central limit theorem. And that means that if we have huge amounts of data, we can use normal distributions, which make calculations a lot easier in most cases. Now, I mentioned that the Bayes approach has a number of advantages. One of the advantages is that if you are in the position to have a good idea what the prior distribution is, you can get much tighter results for your hypothesis tests and for your estimates. The second is that there's an alternative to the usual significance-based approach for hypothesis testing. I mentioned that there are these problems, first of interpretation in general, that the fact that you reject the null hypothesis means your computation for the null hypothesis for your hypothesis test is wrong. And so there's a good article by a doctor named Stephen Goodman who argues that the p-value or significance level is not a good way to evaluate a single research result. If you take it seriously, you have to interpret it as the expected fraction of erroneous claims in the long run, but it doesn't tell you about the strength of evidence for the current result. In a second article in the same series, he advocates use of the Bayes factor instead. Now, the Bayes factor is the probability of B given A divided by the probability of B in Bayes' law. The probability of A is the prior. And so the Bayes factor for statistics is a number beta, which is the probability of the data computed using the null hypothesis versus the probability of the data given an alternative hypothesis. Now, the alternative hypothesis has to be a precise hypothesis in the same way that the null hypothesis is. You have to be able to use it to compute your probabilities. However, and so that means that choosing the alternative hypothesis is really important, and it's just as difficult here as it is for computing power in the case of the traditional statistics. However, you can do that. You can do it for several different alternative hypotheses, and unlike the question of computing power, there is an obvious candidate for the alternative hypothesis, which is the observed, distribution that is most consistent with the observed data. So with the Bayes factor, the Bayes law becomes the posterior odds of the null hypothesis is equal to beta times the prior odds of the null hypothesis, where if the probability of an event E is P, then the odds of E are P over 1 minus P, right? So we talk about odds of 10 to 1 or 5 to 2 or things like that. That's the odds ratio that we're given here, and that's the probability that something happens against the probability that it doesn't. While the prior odds of H0 depends on the judgment of the researcher, it's the prior, what they came in with. And of course, as usual, the prior probability can be assessed in three different ways. We may have a symmetry argument, as in the case of the loaded die. We may have a frequency argument, as in the case of the temperatures at Tokyo Station annually for 100 years. Or we may have the judgment of the researcher or some combination of the above. However, here we can look at the Bayes factor itself, which depends only on our definitions of the null and alternative hypotheses and the data, and therefore we can consider it objective. It doesn't depend on the judgment of the researcher in any way or the strength of the data that they've used for computing frequencies or anything like that. It's in some sense a purely scientific measure of evidence. Now, it doesn't measure the strength of the case for HA, the alternative hypothesis, or for H0, the null hypothesis, because that depends on the priors. If you have very strong evidence in the past, then that the null hypothesis is true, and you get a result that says that this experiment gives strong evidence for the alternative hypothesis, then you have to factor in all the old evidence and say, well, I'd like to believe that there's an effect here, but because the past evidence is much against it, I also have to consider that there's a good chance that my experiment was faulty or I just got very unlucky and got this result. However, we can say that other things being equal, the evidence is very strong or very weak based only on the Bayes factor. That is, past evidence or prior distributions. If we hold those equal, then this particular experiment is strong evidence or weak evidence. And this is sort of confounded all glommed together in the traditional significance analysis. And one other thing that I'd like to note about the Bayes factor is that, in fact, it's something called a likelihood ratio. The true probability of something is based on the true distribution, but we don't know it. What we can do is we can use our probability to compute various probabilities based on hypothetical distributions. And one of those characterizes the null hypothesis, one characterizes the alternative hypothesis. Now, it's a little bit odd to use probability for these calculations, and so statisticians have invented a different term called likelihood. In ordinary English, probability and likelihood mean the same thing. But in statistics, probability is a true value and likelihood is a value that we calculate based on data and some assumption of a prior distribution. So the Bayes factor then is a ratio of two likelihoods, two probability computations based on hypothetical distributions. However, it's computed differently from most classical likelihood ratios, of which there are quite a few. We saw in the Anscombe example, both the ANOVA and the regression analysis presented so-called F statistics. The F statistic is a likelihood ratio. Finally, what I'd like to say about the Bayes factor is this idea that there is a obvious candidate for the alternative hypothesis. And that is the minimum Bayes factor. So we have a null hypothesis, and we have our alternative hypothesis. Usually the alternative hypothesis is the one that we're trying to prove. So we want to know how strong is the evidence against our, or how strong is the evidence against the null hypothesis. And what we want to do is get the likelihood ratio that is the minimum likelihood ratio for this. So the minimum Bayes factor is computed according to the graph on page 41, and we have two distributions. They're both assumed to be normal distributions, because that's kind of the usual thing. We've drawn them so that they both have the same standard deviation. They're both the same width in some sense. And since they both have the same width, they also both have the same height. And in general, they have completely the same shape. The only thing that's different is that the highest point, which is also the mean and the median, is different. So the distribution for the null hypothesis is the purple one, and the distribution for the alternative is the green one. And the likelihood ratio that we're going to compute is, suppose that we have observed a data that gives us this distribution, and the data gives us an estimate of the mean, mu, is exactly equal to 1. So that's given by z equals to 1. And what we want to calculate then is the likelihood of the null hypothesis over the likelihood of the alternative hypothesis. Well, the likelihood at any point is given by the height of the curve at that point. And so we look at the height of the purple line, which gives us the likelihood for the null hypothesis, and look at the height of the green curve, and we take that ratio of the smaller one over the big one, and it turns out that for the particular assumption of normal curve with with the observation at one standard deviation, gives us a likelihood ratio of about 0.35. And this is the smallest Bayes factor that you can get. So this gives us a standard method for comparing a particular alternative hypothesis or a standard method for choosing an alternative hypothesis, which is the distribution that is implied by the data that we observed.